Hello, everybody, and welcome to our very first podcast, episode one of Samurai Digital Securities podcast. So, what's it called? 404 Security Not Found. So, we've not done one before. First time we've had a go at it. It's probably going to be a complete mess. I have no expectations at all of what we're going to get out of this, but we've got a few topics we're going to talk through basically, and we're just going to chat between ourselves, exchange a few ideas, and that's basically how it works. So it's completely informal, and hopefully you guys will get something from it. So we've got three topics. We're going to talk about the impact of remote working on increasing risk with cybersecurity. For example, bring your own devices, teleconferencing systems that we're using, maybe remote desktop working that we're doing more and more of now, and about the potential issues and security problems that could cause us as a result of sort of mass uptake in those areas. We're also going to have a chat about the government's tracker app, the COVID-19 tracker app, which is obviously a point of people aren't particularly happy about it in some senses, whereas others think it's a very good idea. It's contentious. That's what I'm trying to say. It's a contentious app is what it is. So we're going to be talking a bit about that. Right. So just checking that everybody's here. So I thought I might start off with just ensuring that everybody has a very authoritative and professional sounding persona and voice, because the intention here is that it's going to be a very professional and formal, strict, disciplined podcast. So I want to make sure that everybody can do that properly. So can I check with you, Jack, just to make sure you're sounding very professional and authoritative, please?
Hi, I'm present.
Are you professional?
I get paid. That counts as professional, right?
Okay. And do you have anything to say about the tie that you have in the background?
Tie swing.
Okay, moving on. Yeah. Well, do you know what? I will revisit that with you at some point, but not in episode one. Luke, are you sounding very professional?
Always, Dave. It's what you're paying me to do. Sound professional, look professional.
And authoritative too.
Yes, sir.
And Neil, what about you? Authoritative and professional?
Oh, massively, massively. I love it. Authoritarianism. Yeah, I'm all for that. Yeah.
Good. Right. Okay. So maybe if we introduce ourselves as well, could that be useful? Okay, well, do you want to start, Jack? Do you want to explain who you are and what you do, what your role is at Samurai, and let people know a bit about yourself?
So, I'm Jack, Samurai Jack. I've been working with Samurai for about 2 years now. I'm their data privacy consultant. I love all things GDPR, risk, and such. So, you'll get my perspective today on anything to do with data privacy, risks that could come from it, and hopefully see some wonderful, mentality from me.
Awesome. Thanks, Jack. Luke?
Hi, I'm Luke. I'm a security consultant with Samurai. Been here for about a year now. I've been doing like everything from pen testing, incident response through to like helping Jack with compliance work as well. So it's been a good grounding to get a range of insights into security issues.
Luke's very posh as well, aren't you, Luke?
Absolutely.
And he has a ginger. Andy has a ginger beard.
For those playing at
A
home, they
big
can't see us.
bushy beard.
Imagine a very, very impressive ginger beard on a tall, posh person, and you've got Luke. Is that fair, do you
Let's say that as a compliment, to be fair.
Okay. Neil.
Hi, I'm Neil. I'm a co-founder, technical director at Samurai, which means initially did lots of geeky stuff. Now I still do some geeky stuff, but I get to tell these guys to do geeky stuff, and then I can learn through them. Been around a while. Met Dave at university many, many years ago now. Over 10 years, wasn't it, Dave? Long time
Yeah.
ago, down at Derby.
Yeah, long time for you, mate, because you're young. It doesn't seem very long for me because
Just
I'm old.
a third of my life, really, ago, something like that. And generally love geeking around, doing stuff. created a conference several years ago called SteelCon. Not happening this year because of old Mr. COVID, but hopefully 2021, the year when everything goes back to normal, fingers crossed. So yeah, looking forward to what we're going to get up to on this. Kind of interested, scared, apprehensive, excited. Yeah, all those emotions.
Don't worry about it, Neil. If it's a load of rubbish, we'll just can it. It's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's just approach this like we're going to delete it with great shame and embarrassment.
That's just changed the game there. That's changed the game.
I can't wait for us to get to like episode 100 and then just look back on this and just think, oh my God, what a car crash. I can't believe we walked away from that.
I just will be amazed if we get to episode 100, mate, to be honest with you. Right now, I'm wondering about whether episode 2 is going to happen, to be fair.
I think we're going to get banned. Chased off air.
Can you get banned for pub dinner? Okay.
We can certainly
try. We can make an effort. Is there any podcast police? Is that a thing? Okay. I'm David Day. I'm MD of Samurai, and I'm really, really old. I'm the proper sort of grey-haired old man of cybersecurity, if you like. And I have been around a long time. I've been an academic for many, many years. I taught cybersecurity at the University of Derby. Then I went to Sheffield Hallam University and taught cybersecurity. I actually met Neil at University of Derby towards the back end. And he actually encouraged me to move to Sheffield Hallam. Did 6 years at Derby, 6 years at Hallam, did a year at De Montfort. But by that point, you know, Samurai was really taking off. Me and Neil decided to jump out of the life of academia because we were enjoying actually being practitioners more than academics. I think that's probably fair to say, isn't it, Neil? Do you think? So we kind of made that transition, but we, you know, there's still, you know, once you've done that job, it's always still in you. So we still like to go back to the occasional guest lecture or, do some AL associate lecturing as well at other universities, including Warwick University, where we've got contacts actually through when I worked at Derby. So we've been running Samurai full time for what, 2 or 3 years, is it now? 2016, I think, actually.
Yeah, we formed it in 2016, so we're it was December. So, but yeah, arguably three. I'm going to do a really bad maths now. 3 years and 4 months, 5 months.
I think, in fairness as well, we were kind of, you know, we were doing quite a lot of work kind of on the side from university.
I don't know what you're talking about there, Dave. I don't have a recollection, Your Honour. I mean, Dave.
No, we never. Fair enough. No, we never did that. That was a total fib. Made it up. Right. So the three topics we're going to work through today, I'm just going to throw the title out there and I'm just going to, you know, poll opinion, jump around and see who's got to say what. Right. So start off with then. Well, let's have a chat about the impact of remote working on increasing risk. So what we feel might be, shall we start with what we think the main areas of concern might be with that? So I'll kick off, right? My immediate thoughts would be, maybe, issues with people being lax with teleconferencing. And the other one would be maybe remote desktop work. But obviously, we have done work with teleconferencing and we have done work looking at remote desktop environments as well and their impacts on security with clients. Anything else that we can think of that might create a security issue due to working at home? Guys, Luke?
I just think it's more generally about kind of like weakened security controls. Like people had to kind of completely change how they're working. So a lot of people work from the office 9 to 5, but in order to continue doing business, they then had to suddenly, like almost like within just a week or two, completely change how their business operates, which I'm sure has brought many unique challenges. Some of them we've been helping our clients solve with technologies, like you said, Dave, like virtual desktop and stuff like that. But I feel like some of the solutions that people have been pushed aren't as tested as maybe they could have been. Like a prime example of that, but going back to what you said as well, is like something like Zoom. So it was pushed through, like hailed as like the next big thing, but without robust security, like testing are based around that, but with those like procurement decisions, people just like steamrolled it and not everybody got it right straight away. So it's just another.
Shall we spend a little bit of time talking about Zoom? Because we every morning at Samurai, what we do, particularly at the moment, I mean, we try to catch up regularly between us anyway, but particularly at the moment, we're all working remotely. This podcast is being generated in four different locations. So we're not obviously we're not together while we're doing this this podcast. So, but what we're doing in the mornings is we have a meeting which takes place where we all talk to each other, and on this particular occasion we were all connected via Zoom, and then we decided to have a look at how secure it was, and before you know it, we were just sort of, you know, really having at it and discovering what the issues were. Shall we talk about that? Is that worth chatting about?
Yeah, definitely. It was some good. Well, it was an interesting morning, put it that way. I think we all had quite a bit of fun, didn't we? Yeah, I just can't believe. Like, so it was a really great meeting. Just all there is like a little hacking scrum going along. But I mean, some of the Zoom bombing and stuff like that, getting into other people's unsecured meetings, which is possible. Not saying necessarily that we did that, but it's possible. And also the hijacking of audio was another interesting finding as well. That even when people had secured their meetings, you could dial in to their meeting using the telephone and just take over what they were saying. That was a pretty good one. Sesty one, thank you, Neil.
Yeah, we were pretty cool because off the back of that we wrote a blog article and also I was chatting with name dropping here, Rory Clinton Jones, who actually we had a telephone conversation about it. We thought it might end up like a TV news piece, but it didn't. But the blog got he was really kind and retweeted the blog article, which did quite well for us in terms of popularity. I don't know, Neil, Jack. You know, what about this the taking over the audio? Because I think that's one side of things which wasn't really discussed too much, you know, by other parties in terms of issues with you know, particularly with Zoom.
Yeah, I think well, one of the main issues we found was, like, Zoom actually, even back then, did have some security protections, but by default, they weren't enabled. So the problem was happening that with this, as Luke said, the massive rollout, the rapid rollout, which kind of had to happen, because if you weren't able to roll it out quickly, then, you know, your company wasn't going to be able to function, and everybody was in a bit of disarray. And again, what we found were there were several issues in there that could be fixed quite easily by going into the admin menu and turning things off. But you just had this massive influx, and you could see that reflected in the stock price of Zoom as it went through the roof, as everyone started buying Zoom shares for what was happening. And what we would say we did, we looked at two sides in terms of, we looked at, you know, the mistakes that you could make when setting things up, like, you know, allowing Zoom bombing to happen by not having passworded, protected meetings. But what we also found was that there was a disparity between the web sort of console and the option to dial in via like a telephone or a mobile phone, and that the security for the two sides wasn't equal. As in, a lot of focus was thrown on the website, but actually the classic call up a telephone number and access the meeting wasn't given as much sort of attention and security, really. And when we did look into it, there were options in there to fix that. But the problem was that the default and was default for a long time prior to COVID hitting and from a period afterwards was that you could basically access things and get into many different people's conversations and meetings that you shouldn't be able to. So we spent quite a bit of time working with companies we knew that use Zoom and kind of tried to give them advice and guidance on, look, actually, if you go in and you change these options, you can raise the security bar quite a lot. I mean, since then, Zoom have stepped the game up, haven't they? Because now they have lobbies and things like that, which work quite well. But one of the things that we were put onto, I think, I'm not sure who found it originally, was it you, Dave? You found a more secure option, which was end-to-end encryption, which I think it was Jitsi, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I had a conversation. Actually, it was recommended to me by somebody. Simon, his name is. There's a name check. Who recommended it on LinkedIn because it's you know, fully end-to-end encrypted. So in other words, you know, you make your connection via a server, and then it's off, you know, the connection is offloaded, so it ends up being peer-to-peer and encrypted peer-to-peer. So the idea behind that is it's meant to be, you know, more secure, arguably more secure. However, sort of my initial sort of experiences with it, you know, from the, you know, utilizing the sort of trial public server mechanism whereby you connect to a server that they own, and then it it offloads so you can talk directly with the party. To be perfectly fair, the quality wasn't very good. There was a few times where I had to sort of terminate those calls and had to sort of do them again in either Teams or Zoom or some other form of teleconferencing, just because it just didn't seem to make good use of the bandwidth, or it used a lot of the bandwidth. I'm not sure why it wasn't good, but the quality wasn't great. And I think you had some
We tried it with a client who was very security conscious, so we said to him, let's give it a whirl and see how it works. And the screen share was very, very, very limited. But what we did after we looked into it, we were using their kind of trial server, but there was a full guide on how to deploy and roll your own server, which I think is what we're going to have a play with, isn't it, to try and see how it can be if you have your own server. Because one of the other things that off the back of looking at Zoom we came across was that on the public or the free server, you select your own room number, your own room ID. And if you select a room ID that is quite simple or basic, then obviously that's going to allow people to, in essence, jitsu bomb you and get into that room. But I mean, the counter argument there is that you can put a password on the room. And if you are really bothered about security, you should really, you know, host your own server or use a company or organization who have the server. You know, anything that's kind of free on the internet, you have to sort of take with a pinch of salt sometimes, haven't you? It's nice for a trial, but I wouldn't use it as business as usual operations.
I got the feeling. I had an interesting chat Darren Martin, who used to be Infodox, I think, a long time ago, long, long time ago. Sorry if I'm embarrassing you there, Darren, with Ulsec. And we had a really interesting chat on Twitter about this. And, my gut feeling based on that communication was that Jitsi's really not designed for casual users. You know, it's not designed for people who just want a quick jump on, have a teleconference call, hosted by somebody else. You know, it's not competition for Zoom, for example, or Teams. My view on it is it's more a case of if you wanted to host your own environment, you know, as Neil was saying, you put it on your own server and you'd host the entire thing yourself and be in control of it yourself. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're looking at it for a couple of reasons. First of all, because it would be completely encrypted. So from a security point of view, clearly that's something where security and privacy is something where, as you can imagine, extremely passionate about. But secondly, if I'm being totally transparent, I think it'd be pretty cool, you know, to be able to have our own sort of encrypted teleconferencing server. So, yeah, that's where we were with Jitsi. We looked at a few others as well, didn't we? I think there was one called Wire, didn't we look at that too, and a few others. But, we were pretty harsh on Zoom in our blog, very harsh, in fact. But I think at that point that was fair because those defaults really did suck. And people were jumping to it en masse, if you like. But you know, the changes are made now. Pretty much none of that stuff. In fact, I don't think any of the stuff that we did originally in that initial blog you can now do with Zoom. You know, they've changed. It was just about because the security was always there. It just wasn't on by default, and it is on by default now. And I'd like to think we played small part in that happening.
Yeah, a few weeks afterwards, they implemented a 90-day freeze for any feature updates, and they actually said that we're going to just look into improving the security of all this. And so I was reading it up a little while ago, and I think we released a blog not too long ago that shows the updates that were on there. But with the whole COVID thing kicking off and this getting found, I don't think it would have gotten found if people weren't working remotely. And it highlights how shocking the culture of privacy is in some organizations, and even just across the public. We haven't educated the people enough to understand that our information should be secure, and that whilst we're working remotely, there are so many risks out there. I mean, my dad gets texts every other day saying, oh, maybe you've got COVID. Click here and take our survey and we'll be able to do this. And it looks like the NHS.
Oh, sorry about that, Jack. It's just a thing with me and your dad.
Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Sorry, mate, go on.
But it kind of highlights where there's a lack of education there, and even from it being promoted in companies where they should be teaching employees that this information should be secure, that everything we do, consider some companies don't use VPNs, So their traffic is going direct to an inbox, direct to maybe a file share that they haven't got through Google Drive or OneDrive and it isn't secured. And if someone intercepts that, then that's data that's getting stolen. It could get shared, it could go out, and it isn't that difficult. And all it takes is a few simple steps to stop the traffic going in, to add a little bit of monitoring, a bit of access control, and just see what people are doing. And it's not even about lording over, oh, you need to have this installed, you need to have this installed. It's just simple protections to say, right, data shouldn't be accessed from or by certain people. Only you can see it.
Do you think it's come as a bit of a shock? I mean, you know, there was no plan in place for this, the whole sort of COVID lockdown and working from home that came about. It was like 1 minute my kids were at school, the next minute they're at home, the next minute you're not supposed to go into work. It all happened so quickly. There wasn't really time for organisations to come up with a plan or a policy, if you like, or a process for how we're going to do this, you know, en masse working from home. So do you think that in our sort of rush to get operational quickly with, you know, that could have had an implication upon
how seriously massively we're taking security? And I've got an example. So I've got, as probably anyone who works in most industries, if you work in an industry, your friends and family just think you could provide that service for free. So I know everybody in this chat and most people in security get called upon when anyone's computer breaks and anything like that. But I have a friend. And a friend works at a company, and the company rolled out a COVID response where everybody would work from home, which all makes sense. Initially, when you're going to sort of try to get 2,000-3,000 people working from home, you might not have enough laptops. So the classic thing to do is to ask people to use their own laptops, and there's a whole room of issues that I'm not going to go into there, but let's be honest, if you want to get things moving, that's the way to do it. So what was interesting about the conversation I had with him, he basically called me up and said, I've had an email from I think it was PayPal saying that, you know, a transfer has been set up from your account to another environment, to another bank account. And basically what happened is someone got into their PayPal and, you know, set up a payment to go somewhere else. So being his good friend, I logged onto his computer remotely. I had a look and I basically found that, yeah, somebody had been in and around his computer. I said, well, what's going on there? He said, oh, well, when we went remote work, we had an overseas IT provider log in remotely to set our computers up for remote access. Now, I can't say for sure or not, but for what I could see, somebody else had gone into his computer, done some things they shouldn't have done, and gained access to accounts and things that really shouldn't have been there. And I double-checked this because I think he was having issues with his Gmail or Hotmail, I can't remember. But, you know, you can look at, like, failed login attempts and the date of when this individual logged onto their computer and did the thing to the failed log-on attempts and all these kind of weird, suspicious activity kind of matched up a little bit. So I'm not saying that, you know, IT providers are unscrupulous or anything like that. I kind of am saying that as well, though. But the idea is that I think in the speed to get things going, because it has to be done, let's be honest, the other option would be he gets sent home and that company can't do any kind of business or work. So it's, you know, lesser of two evils, I guess. But it's that kind of, you know, when you're forced to make a big change like that, it can cause problems, can't it? Because you're forced to, well, Google the best online system to do face chats. Oh, it's Zoom. Or we need to deploy 2,000 people remotely. We'll use their own laptops and we will then you know, let people install stuff on them and it's going to go crazy. And so I think that was, for me, an interesting experience, because I don't think you could say don't allow this person to use their home computer because it's going to cause problems. But, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I think it's a perception to risk. I find it fascinating, to be honest with you. It's almost like, you know, we've changed environment. When you're at work and in the office, there's a certain perception of risk and what's acceptable. You change the dynamic, you know, you put people at home, you know, you broadcast things on the news which are a bit scary, and all of a sudden our adoption to risk changes and loosens and modifies, and it certainly would appear that it gets worse in this instance. I can remember as a youngster when I was the age of the other podcasters, I used to go away on holiday and didn't think anything at all of renting out, I don't know, like a 125 motorbike or moped or whatever it might be. And I'd blast everywhere on this thing, you know, absolutely flat stick. with totally carefree, with a pair of flip-flops on, a pair of shorts, no top, not a problem. Didn't think anything of it. And, you know, but I would never in my wildest dreams, good weather permitting, would have done such a thing in the UK. Just no chances. You know, full leathers, the helmet, the gloves, everything completely geared up. Going on a bigger bike, sure, but going up quite often similar speeds or even less. But I wouldn't have dreamt of doing anything differently. But suddenly you change your environment, you change the dynamic, and all of a sudden your whole perception of risk seems to change. And I don't know whether that's a particularly good analogy, but I think you can take my point that suddenly you're at home. You maybe because you're more relaxed, perhaps at home. I don't know whether that's something to do with it.
But to like extend your analogy, you have the leathers and like the helmet and stuff like that, and like the other protection measures. But a lot of these companies, like they didn't have it, did they? They just had to get things deployed. And like when it's like it's the cost of doing business, I get it. It becomes at that point, which is kind of a scary thing to measure it against, I guess, that people just, they have to do it. And because of that, then there's going to be so many issues, I guess. So in not preparing for remote working and stuff like that, then they missed out.
Yeah, there's a point you've got there, like about remote working, right? And how a lot of companies had no remote working provision whatsoever. And as we found, right, we were quite lucky because we do a lot of remote working. So the transition for us was quite easy. And in conversations I've had with other clients, we've got those companies that had some form of remote provision, obviously seem to adapt better than those companies that had zero provision, as you're saying, Luke, because if you've never had to provision anything remotely, you know, day one of COVID, you know, shutdown kicks in, you're in a tricky situation, aren't you?
It's just like, just extending the point that I was making, I think like a lot of people didn't have any provision for remote working, but at Samurai, we do a lot of remote working anyway. So we were kind of ready to go on that front.
Yeah.
As opposed to some of the like customers that we serve, and we've had to like try and help spin up virtual desktop environments for them, or other remote working tools for them. That it's just been much easier transition for us compared to some of the bigger people that just haven't had the tools available for them.
And of course, there is the whole thing, as you said, is that, you know, a lot of people get provisioned with laptops, normally in sales environments, but not everybody gets given a laptop. So as you know, people are using their own tools, they're using their own devices, and you know, one minute they're using them for looking at sensitive work documents, and the next minute they're using them for looking at the not sensitive work documents.
Yeah, and you couldn't buy makes sense, Dave. You couldn't buy laptops as well. I've got a friend who's trying to buy a new laptop, right? And he ordered it around COVID time, around March time when it first all really kicked in, and he's getting it next week. So I think an IT provider we work with told me something like the channel that sell laptops did a month's worth of business in one day. So you can imagine, like. So then you've got an even worse situation because we can't even provide them with work laptops because we can't buy any. It makes it even more difficult.
So what do we think about, I mean, you know, what are the workarounds for this problem, if you like? The difficulty that we have with the fact that everybody's using their own home laptops, and their home laptops, for the most part, suck from a security point of view. And the sort of the proposed solution to this is the use of remote desktop, isn't it? It's the use of, you know, remote desktop protocol, RDP systems, you know, VDI, you know, the mechanisms of getting a session from a server and using that environment rather than your own environment. Is that a reasonable solution, do we think?
Yeah, definitely. I think as long as it's well implemented, then I don't think it mitigates quite a lot of the risk that we were facing, like when we were doing that architecture review and then security pen test for that healthcare provider earlier when we were going into the crisis. So then their employees could work remotely. I think it addressed a lot of the concerns, and it's certainly come on a long way, VDI. It's much more like you're there sat in front of your local machine than some of the frustrations that previously did. So them actually able to do business, that barrier is kind of released, and there's much less risk that's facing them. in terms of like malware infections on like local machines and stuff like that. Obviously, there is still a risk.
I can remember when this was kind of new, that the whole sort of, you know, I mean, back in the sort of Microsoft Terminal Services days, in the, I don't know, probably late 90s, I sort of remember it starting to take off. As an experience, it sucked. But obviously now, you know, it really is feeling, I mean, if you have a decent broadband connection, and let's be honest, that is an important part of this, it's almost seamless. So I guess, you know, that is a solution, really. I think as long as your broadband service is up to it, is a pretty solid one, isn't it? What do you think, Jack?
I'm thinking a little bit negatively here on the business side of it. I don't know if I'm being too critical in my head now, but with the whole going back to COVID and people remote working and not being prepared for it, does that not highlight a crucial issue? Most businesses would do a business, a business impact assessment and a business recovery plan. And surely the plan should indicate what would happen if you had a completely business stopping issue, or should highlight areas where if you had to move location. So for example, we had to do one. What would we do in the event of a complete and utter disaster? And it happened. A disaster happened. We couldn't go to the office, so we enacted it and we worked remote. We put VPN in place, we made sure we did what we did. And fair enough, we're experts in the field and we know what we're doing. But why haven't businesses reached out to people who know what they're doing to find out what they would do in the event of a disaster? If their office went down and up in smoke, how would they continue to operate on a day-to-day basis without being able to do all this stuff they're doing now? And the fact that they didn't have, I mean, fair enough, it costs investment. And I really do hope that this has highlighted to people how key it is to invest in recovery planning, in, you know, monitoring systems and in security and privacy within the business. I feel like as soon as this ends, they're all going to go back into their safe little spaces and do exactly what they've always done. But it's 2020. People can work from home. People can work from anywhere in the world. We should not be constrained by time anymore or by location if we don't need to. I understand sales reps need to see people face to face. But if the business can put this in place and the business can plan for this through their risk assessment, why hadn't they considered that? And why hadn't their impact assessments or recovery plans actually highlighted that they would have had a safe way of working once this happened? Why did it take so long for them to act on it?
That's an interesting point, that, Jack. So there's two things I'd like to say to that. The first one is you need to buy some WD-40, mate, because you've got a really squeaky chair. And the other lubricating oils are available. And the other thing I'd like to say as well is, apparently, you know, I mean, I can't, you know, there's a particular client, we all know who I'm talking about, but for legal reasons, I can't say who it is. We had discussions with a particular client, and those things had been discussed already. So, and even specifically this issue had been discussed, particularly about a virus causing lockdown to take place. So this organisation had actually even considered that. And the difficulty is that even though maybe the smarter guys can see it and they can suggest it and they can say it's a problem and they can say it needs addressing, there's this inherent problem that we have. And, you know, I love my psychology, right? But there's this inherent problem, I think, that we all have with wanting to accept the fact that something bad can happen. It's almost like, you know, we're all very good at looking, you know, there's a thing with the stock exchange, isn't there? Apparently that if your shares are going up, then you will check the stock exchange all the time. But if your shares are going down, you will stop looking and ignore it. It's like,
yeah, I've not checked my Bitcoins today or yesterday because they're going down. Well, you just it's very true, mate.
Well, just remember when you say your Bitcoins, what you mean to say is our Bitcoins. So, because some of those are mine, right?
What Bitcoins? What are you talking about? we have the Samurai wallet. Don't worry, we have the Samurai wallet. It's sat there. It ebbs and flows in terms of its value. I think last time I checked, it was worth 80 quid.
80 quid, mate. What are we going to do with that?
Yeah. The options. In these
difficult times of COVID lockdown, we're saved by our £80 worth of Bitcoins.
Exactly.
But yeah, so there's this inability for us to accept the fact that bad things are coming, the fact that, that something could go wrong. And as a result of that, I think it's one of the reasons that probably the, one of the single most things that I don't know whether you guys would agree, but I see with clients is that they don't do a risk assessment, and they don't do even, you know, probably the, and the key part, business continuity, you know, isn't being performed by organizations. They're not actually thinking, what would we do if this happened? And you're absolutely right, Jack. You're absolutely right that we need to look at that.
So one of the things I've been looking into recently is how to improve this. And apparently, it's the best way to do it is to implement a model and get a sponsor from management, from someone who understands risk within your organization, but is also a member of the management or executive board. And once you can sort of communicate to them, convey how terrible things can be if they don't consider these risks, then they can be a sponsor. They can come in and they can go, right, we need a team. We need someone to look into this, and we need management. We need, you know, the executives, the board of directors, to be the ones to understand what could happen to this. And then they need to be the ones to push it. If they don't push it, the rest of the employees aren't going to follow, which kind of shows people went out, they didn't have laptops, they couldn't work. So of course they're not going to do anything. But if the business continuity plan had been put in place, if management had considered it and enacted it, then they would have been the guiding force to say, this is what we will do. Everybody needs a leader to tell them what to do, and the leader of the company should be the one to tell them what to do.
Agreed. Yeah, pushing on an open door with me, mate, as an old boss of mine and Neil's used to say.
Yeah, another one. Definitely. Yeah.
So okay. Shall we move on, because we've already exceeded the amount of time that we're meant to spend on that topic anyway, and have a chat about the Tracker app, the government's Tracker app. Obviously, you know, nobody on this podcast cares the least about privacy or security or people's human rights, and violation of them is what we consider perfectly legitimate and for government to do. Correct?
No, we're just not complying with the
silence speaks the volumes. Though. Yes, we're not sure whether are we joking or not anymore.
Do you think that people might think I'm not joking? Is there a risk of that, do you reckon?
No, okay. No, not at all.
All right, I sincerely hope not. Okay, so Tracker app. It's great, isn't it?
Well, I mean, from the start, I'm not going to go into it straight away to blast it, because I want to start the conversation at, there is a need for this, isn't there? There is a need for track and trace, right? So before we go into the technological pitfalls, and yeah, there are many, we need a form of track and trace, whether it's the contact tracers or the app, because the only way, in my opinion at least, is that you're going to be able to allow society to come back to some kind of normality is to ease restrictions, and to compensate the easing of restrictions, increasing the Boris's R number, which I was actually told the other week, is it contagion? It was actually, it seems Boris, not to get too political, but a lot of Boris's strategy comes from the movie Contagion. my friend was telling me. So I need to go watch that now. But anyway, having the track and trace allows us to bring a level of normality back to society, businesses and everything, whilst keeping, you know, the R number down and allowing things to happen. So I actually agree that we need track and trace as a system. Its implementation, though, that's where it gets fun and exciting and all scary and stuff.
So do you know why pirates are highly susceptible to coronavirus?
I think I could work it out, but I'm going to let you. I know there's a joke in there, but let's. I mean, if you want to call it a joke?
Because they have a very high R rating.
You can hear sirens in the background. There's the podcast police. They're coming.
I think that's a great place to just leave the podcast. We're done. drop the mic. We're out of here.
No, listen. Podcast, it's please. Like the R rating and R for pirates.
High level.
That's what I was doing. So.
Oh, now you explain. Right. Sorry. Yeah.
It's quite a, you know, it's a, you know, no. It's quite a difficult joke to, yeah. Anyway.
4D joke.
So yeah, the tracking app. So you basically sung its virtues, really, Neil. So you love it, then, yeah? Okay.
No, not all. When we get into it,
and you hate Edward Snowden, don't you, as well, the freedom fighter?
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah. I think everyone.
I get your politics now.
I mean, if we want to go into, like, I think Bill Gates should inject everybody with a microchip. I think that's the best way to really control society.
He has actually been injected with a microchip and did it voluntarily of his own free will.
Exactly. See, so what's the issue?
The RFID thing, so he can open doors and things with his hand.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with you, actually, Neil, to be honest with you, on the bits that you've said so far in terms of the fact that it is a good idea to have something that can that can keep a track on what's happening in terms of the spread of the disease. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I haven't spent an awful lot of time looking into it and the logistics of it and the processes and mechanisms of how it operates. But I can see good and bad, and the bit which I thought, oh, okay, I get where you're coming from is the premise that there's an ID that sits with your phone, that's tied to your phone, and the phone is communicating via Bluetooth, and the Bluetooth communications are interacting with other people who have their app, and the diver device is communicating over Bluetooth, but. At that point, at least, as far as I understand it, the only information that is being stored is an ID, which is entirely anonymous. It's tied to nothing but your phone. Or is it anonymous? So there's something I want to discuss as well. And then there's the other part of it, which is that if you actually then, you know, the app asks you, have you got a temperature? Have you got a persistent cough? And if you have, then it recommends you get tested and gives you some other advice. Presumably, if the test is positive, I don't know which point it decides it needs to communicate with other parties. But at some point, if it determines that you have coronavirus, information is then shared with other parties to tell them that they've been in contact or been near somebody who could potentially have coronavirus and give them advice on what they need to do in order to protect themselves and their families and those around them. So when you look at it from that point of view, you're thinking, well, nobody's name and contact details are being exchanged at that point. However, there is a central database. So information relating to, presumably, to the phones and these ID numbers and the places where that person has been, their location, is all being saved to a central server, which is in opposed to the ID. So this is for the NHSX developed app, as opposed to what was proposed as a similar system to do a similar thing by Apple and Google, which was all the information was kept locally. And not stored on a server. And my concern, I guess, comes from the fact that can this information be de-anonymized? And these discussions have been around for a while, right? So here's the first one, right? Straight off the bat, this occurs to me immediately, right? So you activate the app, you put Bluetooth on, you're sat at home, you spend most of your time at home, almost all of your time spent at home. It's not difficult to associate an individual with the place that they live and they abide. So, you know, almost straight away, by having the location and the ID, you've pretty much nailed, you know, you've at least narrowed it down to the people in your household, haven't you? And then, you know, if you look at the journeys that they take, let's say, you know, you've got a journey from my house to my office, and then you've got actually the location of my house as well. You're pretty much, you've got the individual. You know who that, you know, whoever is responsible for holding that database can very, very easily identify the individual from that ID. You don't need their name and address. Their address has already been given away by their location. And or is that the case? Or does it not work like that? Does it not use the GPS? Does it just use the Bluetooth? So in other words, it doesn't actually grab your location. It just grabs the information of how close you are to another that's got the app.
So supposedly it uses Bluetooth and it uses the signal strength depending on how close you are to the nearest unique ID from their phone. It records the phone that you're using. It does use an IP address, which is only used apparently for the security team to access. No one else can access that and it doesn't get stored in the central database. And what else was there? Apparently that's stored on the phone, and I was reading into it earlier, but I didn't get any further than that part when I came onto this. So a little bit more research is needed to be done to understand it. But one of the things is they need to take a postcode. So they actually take your partial postcode, the first three letters, which obviously shows the area you're in. If someone can hack that, they can see where you are. They can get onto your phone using, so like if you Bluetooth on all the time, then that's a security risk, because there's a lot of flaws in Bluetooth and people can connect using device IDs or using something that's known or familiar. We mentioned before, I mean, Luke were talking how this podcasting thing shows the headphones that I'm using. And if there was a security flaw in my headphones through Bluetooth, then an attacker could leverage that to get onto my phone, to then be able to find wherever it is that it is being stored, which could have my partial postcode, just as I'm walking about. And they've then got information about me. I don't know if there's anything else they could do with that, but like you say, if they've already got some of the information, we know too well how easy it is to find more.
I'm just looking now, actually, and I'm not entirely sure someone. Whether at initial launch it's going to use GPS or whether there are plans to use GPS, but there is some talk.
Only on Android phones at the moment is location being used, because Android phones need location on to be able to allow Bluetooth to work in the background.
Oh, is that right? Check Jack out. Jack's actually done his homework.
Oh, yeah. You think I do nothing all day, I swear.
You are now the NHS tracking app expert, Jack.
I've got a question for you then, Jack, right? Is one, because I think you're more well versed in this than me, right? Yeah. So when I heard the UK government basically decided we're not going to go with Google and Apple's approach of using a decentralized model, we're going to use a centralized model. So to me, I'm thinking initially, I have privacy concerns about Google and Apple anyway, but the government and Google and Apple, I don't know how I sit on that, but having a centralized database means that if that database could, as Dave said, be de-anonymized, if that database could be accessed, how long does that database live for is another question I want to ask as well. But what do you have any view on the difference between this decentralized approach and the centralized approach that the UK government has taken?
If it's decentralized, then fair enough. It's you know, usually recorded on the phone. It isn't stored anywhere from, like Google wouldn't keep their own repository of that data and couldn't use it later on. It couldn't be hacked. Mm-hmm. And we all know, we've seen companies that are supposedly secure and later on a flaw comes out and they end up getting hacked. It happens on social media. It happens on banks. It happens everywhere. So it's all about improving security over time. When it comes to the centralized approach, then you've got that risk then of the data being susceptible to someone just getting it. I don't know how they could. They could hack it, a disgruntled employee, or it could be a flaw in the system that we don't know about now, and it allows information to be sent that then forwards information to an attacker. We don't know. But I don't trust a centralized approach, because I wouldn't want my information being taken off my phone to be put somewhere else when, as someone who understands privacy at least a little bit, I would say, compared to other people who don't, who have no clue about what data privacy is and what is happening with their information, I wouldn't want a partial postcode to be shared. I wouldn't want my device name, my device ID, anything like that to be shared. I wouldn't want, you know, anything that someone else could leverage to be able to get access to. And I definitely wouldn't want it being stored for an extended period of time.
That, for me, that last point, the extended amount of time is like any data. The longer it exists for, the more risk it is in it. And the more other people think, ooh, maybe we could also do this with the data. I've got a really good idea of how we could use this to, and we use crime as an example, yeah? So I think this chap is, is involved in crime. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a little look, see if they ever use a Trace app, right? Getting really tinfoil hat now. And we're going to see if they were connected to anybody, who they were around, and we can build associate maps and things like that, which this all comes back to the point of, well, how much information does it store that can be traced back to an individual, and can you still have access to that information after, you know, COVID is hopefully long gone?
If you had, that was like going to be my argument. I was like playing through that whole scenario in my head, like if the police get access to somebody's phone and then they look at the track and trace app and then they see, but then But then, as I understand it, they would only ever see the other IDs of the phones that that individual's been in contact with. But I suppose if you got, if you had two suspects and you could had both access to both their phones, then you could see that both of them had been in contact, in which case then they're nicked, right? Effectively, you've got that association. But I think doing it, the real risk would come if you could do that remotely. That'd be the only thing that I've worried about. But after reading the NCSC's white paper, I'm not sure that you could. But I hope they don't...
The true question, yeah, is after the white paper has been read, right, and we've looked at this, I mean, we people need to take it to pieces, don't they? Let's be honest, right? This is a lot of what we're talking about is all based on how much does it store, what does it do with it, how does it handle it? So we've got a lot of speculation, haven't we, about the model that they've chosen. But the question is, on the ground, how does it look? How does it really work? What can you do with it?
Absolutely. And like, how long, so after the COVID crisis finishes, if, when, like when is this going to, database is going to go away? Is it going to go away or is it going to become extended exactly. until it gets, and this is proper tinfoil hat now, I'm listening yeah. to myself.
Yeah, but, exactly. Waiting for pandemic number two.
Yeah, but like in a similar way to yeah. like China has surveillance on its citizens, is that something that potentially this database could be extended to? Or like be shoehorned, like, oh, we've already got this, and then it progresses on.
It's a powerful tool.
Incredibly powerful.
That's what I'm saying. It's you know, it's, oh, do we want to get rid of this? Maybe there, and I'm not saying people would do it with malicious intent initially, but if, do you know what? We've gathered all that data. It'd be great if we could do something with it.
Just to pick up on that, is this, and this was probably going to you, Jack, really, from a, because as resident GDPR expert, but are we do all the same principles still apply? So if I was to turn around to NHSX and say to them, look, I want my information to be removed, deleted, right to be forgotten, all of that, totally, utterly destroyed, can I do that, and could I have confidence that that would happen, do you think, Jack?
I wouldn't be confident it would happen. If you look at GDPR or even most European data laws, and even the Data Protection Act, it stipulates that the government can basically keep your data, take your data, look at what you've got for any reason under national security. And under GDPR, it also says public health or vital interest. So it's under the vital interest of the public for them to know this information, because it would stop health issues. It could stop a health crisis. Whether or not that's true, I mean, coming back to the centralized and decentralized, there is an argument for having a centralized database. At the very least, that information isn't just stored on a person's phone, and it gives the NHS access to it, and they'll be able to monitor trends statistically to be able to see where people go, how often they go, where the virus is spread the most. And we could then see whether or not it, because there's all this speculation of whether or not it affects people outside, inside, whether a mask helps. And if we know people have been to a certain area and they've been on the beach, then we know that if there is a big spread, then being outside necessarily doesn't help us. Whereas if that didn't happen, if we know people have been everywhere, but then they start recording that they've been indoors, then we know that it is because they're indoors. So it could help us to be able to find out more information about what's happening about the spread. But when we come back onto the holding data and the, you know, them deciding to keep it longer, they could very easily just say, we need this for XYZ reasons, and we can use this data to prove it. And I wouldn't necessarily think it would be good. I don't think there are any good reasons to keep it after COVID. Once COVID is done, the app isn't needed. We don't need to record people. We don't need to watch people, let people go back to their lives. But during it, I mean, there are arguments for and against, and I'm sort of in the middle at the moment. I don't know. I don't know what I would think is good or bad, especially not without all the information. But I would be wary, because it does always start with, well, we'll use this. Well, we'll use this. And then it becomes, well, now everybody has to use this. Then it becomes, well, we've had it, let's keep it. And it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, do you know what, Jack? You're worrying me, but at the same time, I think that's a really, really strong point. And on that very strong point, I'd like to bring to a conclusion our very first podcast, 404 Cybersecurity Not Found, Samurai Digital Security Limited's very first podcast. Hope you find it interesting. If you have, I will work out some mechanism of taking comments at some point. But we'll, to be honest, I don't even think I'll bother editing it. I can't be bothered. We just think we'll send it out like this. It's okay, isn't it?
Maybe we should listen through it once, maybe.
Yeah, and then just like pass it on Twitter. Everyone. If you've got any comments.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. And talk to you next time, which will probably be next week. Bye. Say bye.
Bye.
Bye.